Some of the best lessons don't come from a classroom. They come from experience. On The Power of Advice, a new podcast series from Capital Group, you'll hear from CEOs, investors, and founders about how they built careers, took risks, and reinvented themselves. If you're starting your own journey, this is the kind of advice you won't want to miss. Available wherever you get your podcasts. Published by Capital Client Group, Inc.
Hey parents, we all know summer break is for fun, but it's also a time when kids can start losing some of the progress they made during the school year. We want them to stay engaged and keep those young minds active. Between camps, vacations, and family time, it can be tough to keep a learning routine going. That's why I want to tell you about IXL. IXL is an award-winning online learning platform that helps kids truly understand what they're learning. Whether they're building math confidence, strengthening reading and writing skills, or reviewing science concepts. From pre-K through 12th grade, IXL offers personalized interactive learning that adapts to each child's level and pace. It's an easy way to keep learning going through the summer and helps kids feel confident heading into the next school year. Studies show kids who use IXL score higher on tests, proven in all 50 states. And get this, IXL is used in 96 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. That's a huge endorsement. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXLLearning.com/audio. Visit IXLLearning.com/audio to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
The History Channel Original Podcast.
The 1930s is a decade of aggression. Italy attacks Ethiopia, dreaming of a modern Roman Empire. Hitler's thousand-year Reich calls for his seizure of Austria, Czechoslovakia, and Poland. The Japanese Empire expands with the invasion of Manchuria and China, but intends to dominate all of Asia. To accomplish that, the military in Japan know they must first eliminate the United States as a seaborne power. They act accordingly.
This is World War II with Tom Hanks, Episode 4, Pearl Harbor.
In late 1937, the Japanese escalate their military campaign in China. They already occupy Manchuria. After 3 months of fighting, they take Shanghai and move to the ancient Chinese capital of Nanking. The Japanese brutality that follows will shock the world.
They enter the city, and instead of just occupying it, they let the Japanese troops off the leash. They rape, they pillage, they burn, they steal.
The Japanese commanders ordered their soldiers not to take any prisoners, which meant executions.
This was Japanese soldiers looking down on the Chinese as an inferior people and as being non-humans. Japanese soldier who committed atrocities himself, he described it as killing pigs.
Japanese officers had a competition to see who could be the first to kill 100 civilians with a sword.
This was printed in Japanese newspaper.
To show pictures of swordsmen decapitating bound prisoners in the 20th century made the people doing the killing seem almost like they were barbarians from another era. and it struck Americans and people in the Western world in a different way than had they shown people being lined up against a wall and shot.
Hundreds of thousands of people raped and murdered by the Japanese. It was called the Rape of Nanking.
In just 6 weeks, the Japanese army killed 200,000 Chinese in Nanking. Most are civilians.
The Japanese invasion does identify the Japanese as an aggressive power in the Pacific, that they are brutal in the way that they've treated the population. And this starts to change people's perceptions with regards to the Japanese.
By the end of 1939, Japan controls vast areas of North and Central China, as well as the southern port cities. The Japanese are driven by the desire for raw materials.
The luck of the historical draw has put the Japanese people on a series of beautiful islands, which are unfortunately resource poor. Take iron ore. The Japanese have almost no indigenous sources of iron ore. Their steel industry is based on U.S. scrap iron. They need the raw materials and almost limitless manpower of China.
Japan is a modern and complex nation. At the pinnacle of society is the Emperor Hirohito, the 124th Emperor of Japan.
The Constitution made the Emperor of Japan a divine figure, literally a living god.
Taken literally, he's a god on earth, or a mystical figure who people aren't really supposed to have much direct contact with.
Emperor Hirohito is not really a policymaker in Japan. He's not the wartime planner. He doesn't go through details of tax policy in the way you would think a president or a prime minister does. He's a guarantor and a protector of Japanese tradition.
Emperor Hirohito approves government policy, but real power lies with the Japanese army and navy and its political allies. They want Imperial Japan to control Asia.
For the last couple of decades, it has been a major industrial power, powerful economy. Its armed forces have been built up. It's in a really strong position.
The Japanese resent the Western colonial empires that dominate Southeast Asia and control resources. The British rule over Hong Kong, Burma, Malaya, and Singapore. There's French Indochina and the Dutch East Indies. Even the United States has territories called protectorates in Guam and the Philippines. Japan intends to create what they term the Greater East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere under their leadership.
By this point, Japan is Asia's preeminent power by a long way. And I think because of that, the Japanese have a sense that they are destined to bring the rest of Asia with them.
Japan had an interest in becoming the supreme power of not only continental China, but also Asia. Asia for the Asians was one of the propaganda slogans, one of the key slogans of the Japanese Empire. Asia for the Asians was understood by some Japanese politicians at the time as an honest interest in liberating Asia from the Western colonizers. But there were some voices in the Japanese military who had a different understanding of this phrase, Asia for the Asians, saying, okay, Asia for the Asians means actually Asia for Japan.
You get people in the Japanese government who are militarists, who have a very constrained view of the world. Their attitudes are somewhat disdainful of Western comfort and softness and all these sorts of things.
The Japanese believe their soldiers are the toughest in the world. They combine modern weapons with the traditional training and values of the samurai warrior, known as the Code of Bushido.
Bushido was an older tradition that had now been inculcated into the manpower of the Japanese army. The Japanese didn't choose this aspect of their history randomly. They don't have the aircraft to compete with the West. They don't have the heavier tanks and artillery. There needs to be an equalizer, and they believe they found that equalizer in the superior fighting spirit of the Japanese soldier.
By 1940, Japan controls most of China. In Washington, President Franklin D. Roosevelt is alarmed and fears further Japanese aggression could threaten the entire Asian-Pacific region.
Japan is an authoritarian power organized and driven by a theory of racial superiority and a march of aggressive conquest. That was what Japan was doing.
Now, the only problem there is that the United States has traditionally seen the Pacific as its own area of operations.
Roosevelt is determined to dislodge Japan from China, and the Japanese are determined to stay. To counter continued Japanese aggression in China, Roosevelt orders the U.S. fleet to move from San Diego to Pearl Harbor, a naval base on Hawaii, 2,000 miles closer to the Japanese mainland.
This is a land that is an extension of the United States. It is the United States.
Roosevelt is sending a clear signal he hopes will deter Japan. The Pacific is America's sphere of influence.
He wants the fleet to be positioned far enough forward that the Japanese will take it seriously, but at the same time not to be overtly provocative by moving it to a place like the Philippines or maybe Singapore.
Pearl Harbor is now the front line of American naval power in the Pacific.
The Pearl Harbor naval base is perfect because it's got a narrow channel into a wide harbor with an island right in the middle. So it looks like a fortress.
Outside the naval base is the thriving city of Honolulu.
The Hawaiian Islands to America looks like a paradise. Beautiful beaches, relaxed culture, amazing weather.
But there are security concerns among top naval and army commanders.
Because now they are surrounded by a population that is disproportionately Asian, and a population that also includes a very large percentage of Japanese Americans.
30% of the population of the Hawaiian Islands has Japanese heritage.
One of the major fears is sabotage from local Japanese Americans. General Short, who is in charge of the army at Hawaii, is much more afraid of sabotage than air attack. So he takes the fighter planes out of their protective bunkers, lines up on the airfield where he thinks his soldiers can protect them from sabotage. Unfortunately, he's presented a line of sitting ducks.
The U.S. expands its profile in the Pacific at the same time as Germany's forces sweep through Europe and conquer nation after nation.
Hitler doesn't realize what he's done, but in toppling France, he set in motion a kind of ripple effect of aggression that is going to move far and wide.
Going back to the First World War, there's a sense in Japan that when things happen in Europe, there's an opportunity for Japan in Asia. If they can get their hands on something while the big powers are busy in Europe, then they will. That's exactly what happens in June 1940.
Germany's conquests present Japan with an opportunity. Germany now occupies the Netherlands, colonial ruler of the oil-rich Dutch East Indies. Great Britain, still at war with Germany, controls the resources of Malaya, Singapore, Burma, and Hong Kong. and the French, who rule Indochina, have surrendered to the Nazis.
The Japanese now realize that an opportunity is beckoning. The Dutch can't defend the Dutch East Indies any longer. The British are going to have a heck of a time trying to defend Singapore. And on the French in Indochina. The resources await. And it seems to the Japanese that a once-in-a-century opportunity has arisen to seize those colonies. Who's going to defend them?
So the French are overrun by the Nazis. You have a Vichy regime being set up. The Japanese really have their eyes on Indochina because of the resources there, the sense that actually it won't put up much of a fight, given that the French are busy elsewhere.
Japan's first target is French Indochina. In September 1940, it pressures the French Vichy government to cede to them the northern region. That same month, Japan's leaders sign a formal alliance with Germany and Italy called the Tripartite Pact. The three nations become known as the Axis Powers.
One of the characteristics of the Axis, of course, is that they were three hyper-aggressive, militant powers, eager for war.
They're strange bedfellows. There seems to be no overlap between German interests, which are focused on Eurasia, Italian interests focused on the Mediterranean and North and East Africa. Japanese interested are in East Asia. And so there's no obvious overlap between the three. They come together because they're all kind of outcasts.
The Tripartite Pact is a marriage of convenience to try and put the Americans off from entering any kind of conflict with Japan. There isn't a great deal of ideology there. It's simply a case of how do we keep the Americans at bay for now so that we can do what we need to do in Asia.
In the summer of 1941, the American-Japanese relationship reaches crisis level when Japan takes control over all of French Indochina.
The French yield, and the Japanese come down and they start helping themselves to the resources they need to keep the war going. And then eventually they just outright take it over.
It's a great source of resources. It's also a great staging post for whatever else you might want to do in Southeast Asia.
Japan now has access to even more raw materials.
The thinking in Tokyo is we need to get tin and bauxite from Malaya. We need to get oil from the Dutch East Indies. We need to get rice from the Philippines, and everything you need is there. It's a no-brainer.
The United States has one major weapon to force Japan out of China and Southeast Asia. And President Roosevelt is about to use it.
In a world full of noise, long-term thinking stands out. On the Capital Ideas podcast, Capital Group leaders explore the decisions that matter most in investing, leadership, and life. It's a rare look inside a firm that's been helping people pursue their financial goals for more than 90 years. Listen to the Capital Ideas podcast from Capital Group, published by Capital Client Group, Inc. Hey, parents, we all know summer break is for fun, but it's also a time when kids can start losing some of the progress they made during the school year. We want them to stay engaged and keep those young minds active. Between camps, vacations, and family time, it can be tough to keep a learning routine going. That's why I want to tell you about IXL. IXL is an award-winning online learning platform that helps kids truly understand what they're learning. Whether they're building math confidence, strengthening reading and writing skills, or reviewing science concepts, from pre-K through 12th grade, IXL offers personalized interactive learning that adapts to each child's level and pace. It's an easy way to keep learning going through the summer and helps kids feel confident heading into the next school year. Studies show kids who use IXL score higher on tests, proven in all 50 states. And get this, IXL is used in 96 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. That's a huge endorsement. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXLlearning.com/audio. Visit IXLlearning.com/audio to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
In the summer of 1941, the United States takes its strongest stand yet against Japan's territorial ambitions.
The United States has been concerned about Japanese expansion and aggression in Asia for some time. Roosevelt has stopped short of a military response, but there's been a series of embargoes. Embargo on weapons, an embargo on scrap iron.
Japan is almost entirely dependent on oil imported from the U.S. So FDR imposes an embargo on the Japanese.
In the summer of 1941, America essentially turns off the tap.
The embargo becomes a disaster for the Japanese economy and military.
By installing an oil embargo, we have basically said we are going to control your future.
The Japanese have to find a way out. And there's oil nearby. The Dutch, for example, control huge amounts of oil in that region, so it becomes almost a temptation. Why wouldn't you take it? Especially when you feel like the United States had no right to cut you off from oil in the first place. I mean, would a European power stand for that?
The moment Roosevelt turns off the tap, the clock is ticking.
In Tokyo, the Japanese make plans to strike back.
Japan thinks about, how do we get out of this straitjacket? Well, we have to replace those things by seizing the raw materials of Southeast Asia. And the first step will be to knock out the American Pacific Fleet.
The Japanese finalize plans to attack American interests in the Pacific.
There's a sense amongst the Japanese that the Americans are merchants rather than warriors. And that if you do give them a really bloody nose, they'll think, actually, this isn't for us. So if you really show them some proper steel, then they might back away.
But not everyone in Japan is committed to conflict with the United States. Prime Minister Funimaro Kanoe wants to find a peaceful solution.
Very much of a noble background. He is an internationalist. He has great relationships with diplomats in the West. His big concern, I think, is how you reach some kind of a settlement with the United States and manage to bring the Japanese military along with you.
But War Minister Hideki Tojo is determined to go to war against America.
Hideki Tojo does have a very aggressive sense of what Japan is going to have to do. The destiny of Japan is to be the preeminent power in Asia, is to push the Americans out, to push the British out, to push the Dutch out. Look at what's happening in Europe. Look at the success of the Nazis. That is the way a great power is going to run itself in the future.
Emperor Hirohito is caught between the war and peace factions in Tokyo. He gathers his political and military leaders for an imperial conference where he recites a poem written by his grandfather, the Emperor Meiji. Across the four seas, all men are brothers. In such a world, why do the waves rage, the winds roar? The Japanese try to interpret Hirohito's feelings about the war from the poem, but he never states his views explicitly. Prime Minister Kanoe still wants to find a diplomatic solution.
There's no harm done in keeping open channels of communication. Their ambassador and a special envoy in Washington talking to the U.S. State Department.
But the Americans still demand that Japan withdraw from China.
I don't think they see any possibility that this problem can be negotiated away. I think the Japanese have made a pretty firm decision to go to war.
In mid-October 1941, a frustrated Prime Minister Kanoe resigns. He tells his government secretary, "His Imperial Majesty is a pacifist. I told him that war was a mistake.
he agreed. But the next time I met him, he leaned more to war. I felt the emperor was absorbing more and more the view of the army and navy high commands.
Hirohito heard plans being discussed in detail constantly. He never really said yes. But the crucial factor is that he never said no.
War Minister Tojo becomes the new prime minister. Japan's destiny is now in the hands of the military. In Honolulu, there's a new employee at the Japanese consulate, Takeo Yoshikawa.
Takeo Yoshikawa was a member of the Japanese Navy and was sent to Hawaii as a spy.
Yoshikawa is hoping that he's going to find some sympathizers within the Japanese population that'll give him additional information. But what he quickly discovers is that the vast majority of the Japanese Americans on Oahu are loyal to the United States. So he's renting planes to take sightseeing tours around the harbor. He's driving around town. He's taking pictures. I'm a tourist. He's renting boats to go around and actually measure the depth of the harbor and so forth. So he gathers a lot of intelligence about the daily activities of the Pacific Fleet. Yoshikawa is the one who comes up with the insight that Sunday morning really is the best time to launch an attack against the Americans.
Although meant to deter Japan, FDR's order to move the Pacific Fleet base from California to Pearl Harbor means it's now within striking distance.
Roosevelt doesn't really understand that by moving the fleet this far forward, it now becomes a potential target for the Japanese, because the Americans in general don't understand the sophistication and level of capability that the Japanese now have.
On a cold Wednesday morning, the fleet of the Japanese Imperial Navy heads out into the Pacific. In overall command is Grand Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto. It was his plan to launch a surprise attack against the U.S. fleet at Pearl Harbor.
Yamamoto has a really good appreciation for just how powerful the United States is. He's lived in the U.S., he was a naval attaché, he speaks some English, and so he understands that any war with the United States is going to have to be a very fast affair, that they've got to get this thing over as rapidly as possible. Hit them hard at the outset and try to go after American morale. The way he thinks he can do that is by sinking as many of our battleships as possible. Maybe then the Americans will come to the bargaining table and we can get this war over with in 6 months or something like that.
Key to the operation is grouping six modern aircraft carriers together for the attack.
Yamamoto is an air power advocate. He has been consistently pushing to beef up Japan's aircraft carriers. And they create this organization, Kido Butai, the mobile force.
Aircraft carriers are usually deployed one at a time, and their aircraft are tasked with defending heavy battleships.
The Japanese are like, we're going to take all of our carriers, we're going to put them into a carrier fleet of six big flight decks that can now bring 350 aircraft across the ocean. That is going to allow the Japanese to deliver these enormous pulses of firepower over the battlefield, which has never been seen before in naval warfare.
The Japanese have another challenge. How do you get this enormous armada across 3,500 miles of ocean without being detected? First, they shut down all radio communications and travel in silence. Then, 8 oil tankers sail alongside the fleet.
The ability to refuel at sea is one of the masterstrokes of Pearl Harbor, because your fleet didn't have to stop at any bases. This is how the Japanese fleet could stay radio silent. Refueling at sea literally allowed the Japanese fleet to vanish like a ghost.
As the Japanese fleet steams towards Hawaii, in Washington, D.C., the Japanese and the Americans continue to negotiate. On December 6th, President Roosevelt writes to Emperor Hirohito directly. It is clear that a continuance of such a situation is unthinkable. We have a sacred duty to restore traditional amity and prevent further death and destruction in the world.
Roosevelt's saying, look, war would be a horror. This is war that none of us want. But at this point, Hirohito is embarked on war.
The Japanese fleet has reached the point of no return. December 7th, 1941. Just before 4 a.m., a patrol ship, the USS Ward, receives a message. A small submarine has been spotted in the area near Pearl Harbor. At 6:40 a.m., the Ward drops depth charges on the submarine.
They send a sighting report upstairs. The people at Pearl Harbor look at it and they're like, this is a brand new captain. He's only been on duty for a day at this point. He probably doesn't know what he's doing. Don't worry about it. Even though the Ward has successfully fired the first shot in this war, her report is completely ignored.
20 minutes later, two young radar operators spot a huge formation of planes approaching the area. They report it to their senior officer.
He knows that there's a group of American B-17s that are due in this morning that should be coming from roughly that direction. And the result is that he tells those two radar operators, don't worry about it.
183 Japanese planes descend on Pearl Harbor in the first wave of the attack. Their target, the airfields.
The result is going to be this concentrated bombing attack to try to put as many American planes out of business at the outset of the attack.
At 7:55 a.m., the first bombs hit.
When you hear the airplanes overhead, you're like, oh boy, they sure are doing training early today. And then when all of a sudden things start to explode, you're like, oh man, somebody's really going to get in trouble because this training event's way out of hand.
At 8 a.m. on Honolulu, the Japanese spy Takeo Yoshikawa tunes his radio into a Japanese weather forecast. The announcer uses the phrase, Higashi no kazeyame, east wind, rain. It's code. The attack on America is underway. Another formation of Japanese aircraft dive on the ships anchored along Battleship Row.
Torpedo planes at low level and overhead bombers.
It's not until ships actually start exploding, bullets start ripping through the decks, that they realize, oh my God, this is really real.
Torpedo attacks are very, very successful. The Oklahoma and the West Virginia are very heavily hit. Oklahoma ends up capsizing, trapping hundreds of men in this overturned ship.
Over 400 sailors and Marines die on the USS Oklahoma.
At the same time, the level bombers are coming in overhead and dropping their bombs. And one of them lands a devastating hit on the battleship Arizona. And destroys her in just the blink of an eye.
The explosion on the USS Arizona kills 1,117 men.
So if you think about every, you know, soldier, sailor, Marine, they cannot connect the idea of what is happening. There are bombs exploding, there are ships sinking, there are men on fire, there are body parts flying around. And you can imagine just trying to wrap your mind around all that.
After two waves of attack, the Japanese withdraw. ...188 U.S. aircraft are destroyed. 1,178 servicemen and civilians are wounded. 2,403 are dead. But the United States Navy's aircraft carriers are at sea and escape the devastation.
We have witnessed this morning severe bombing of Pearl Harbor by enemy planes. It is no joke. It is a real war.
If we want to talk about the grand inflection point in World War II, it's December 7, 1941. At 7:55, it's the world as we've always known it. 15 minutes later at 8:10, the world is different. We are now at war.
In a world full of noise, long-term thinking stands out. On the Capital Ideas podcast, Capital Group leaders explore the decisions that matter most in investing, leadership, and life. It's a rare look inside a firm that's been helping people pursue their financial goals for more than 90 years. Listen to the Capital Ideas podcast from Capital Group, published by Capital Client Group, Inc.
Hey, parents, we all know summer break is for fun, but it's also a time when kids can start losing some of the progress they made during the school year. We want them to stay engaged and keep those young minds active. Between camps, vacations, and family time, it can be tough to keep a learning routine going. That's why I want to tell you about IXL. IXL is an award-winning online learning platform that helps kids truly understand what they're learning. Whether they're building math confidence, strengthening reading and writing skills, or reviewing science concepts, from pre-K through 12th grade, IXL offers personalized interactive learning that adapts to each child's level and pace. It's an easy way to keep learning going through the summer and helps kids feel confident heading into the next school year. Studies show kids who use IXL score higher on tests, proven in all 50 states. And get this, IXL is used in 96 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. That's a huge endorsement. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXLLearning.com/audio. Visit IXLLearning.com/audio to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing.
And Bubba Wallace.
You know what's the worst part of a race? A rain delay.
Sitting around, waiting for the track to dry, is dull.
But instead of waiting, we hang out with Chumba Casino.
Social casino slots, bingo, solitaire, plenty of fun to keep us entertained.
So why let a rain delay slow you down? Play now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
The America that wakes up on December 8th, 1941, is a different country.
The country's being tested. Are we up to this? Can we meet this challenge? We are being put in the balance, and would we be found wanting or not?
Prime Minister Tojo tells the Japanese people about the victory of its navy at Pearl Harbor. He also tells them that Japan has attacked Singapore, Hong Kong, Malaya, Wake Island, Guam, and the Philippines.
While American attention is focused on the surprise attack, the Japanese are bombing and launching invasions all around. They're bombing Malaya, they're bombing the Philippines.
At 12:30 p.m., Congress assembles.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
He dictated a good part of the speech to his secretary, Grace Tully. And the initial formulation was, yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in world history. And at some point before he gets to Capitol Hill, he writes in a wonderful handwriting of his, date which will live in infamy. So it was his edit of his own dictation that created an indelible phrase.
I ask that the Congress declare that since the unprovoked and dastardly attack by Japan on Sunday, December 7th, 1941, a state of war has existed between the United States and the Japanese Empire.
Look very carefully at what Franklin Roosevelt said on the 8th of December. We are declaring war against the Empire of Japan. He does not mention Germany. The 8th goes by, the 9th goes by, the 10th goes by. And not until the 11th, when Hitler decides to declare war on the United States, did the United States then in turn declare war on Germany.
America now faces a global war on two fronts.
We were dragged into this. Let's be very clear. The United States of America did not wake up in the middle of the 20th century and decide it was going to defeat tyranny. Tyranny had to force us into a struggle that we now recognize to be the great existential struggle, arguably of the last millennium. But it was not a quick or easy date with destiny.
We are now in this war. We're all in it, all the way. Every single man, woman, and child is a partner in the most tremendous undertaking of our American history. It will not only be a long war, it'll be a hard war. We are going to win the war, and we are going to win the peace that follows.
America is now at war, the most devastating in world history. Germany reigns from the Atlantic to the outskirts of Moscow. Imperial Japan has swept across the Pacific, forcing America into an armed struggle it is not yet ready to fight. not on land, not in the air, not at sea.
World War II with Tom Hanks is produced by Newtopia Limited, A&E Factual Studios, Playtone Productions, and Back Pocket Studios in association with Motion Entertainment for the History Channel. This episode was narrated by Tom Hanks and mixed by John Lloyd. Additional voicing provided by me, Jeremy Reagan. From the History Channel, our executive producers are Eli Lehrer and Liv Fidler. For Playtone, executive producers are Tom Hanks and Gary Getzman. For Back Pocket Studios, our executive producer is Ben Dickstein.